Hi, this is Nancy Clare. Welcome to Speaking of Mysteries. The guest for this episode is Otto Penzler, who I interviewed this past weekend at the Mystery Writers Conference that is conducted annually by Book Passage, the fantastic independent bookstore in Corte Madera, California. I've known Otto for quite a few years, the editor of more than 50 mystery short story anthologies, owner of Mysterious Bookshop, the U.S.'s best-known bookstore devoted to mysteries, the publisher and editor-in-chief of the imprint Mysterious Press and MysteriousPress.com. He's the undisputed dean of the genre and has graciously and generously helped me with numerous projects repeatedly over the years. I can honestly say that if it weren't for him, I probably would not be doing this podcast. But he is intimidating, at least to me. So much so that I have never asked him to be on Speaking of Mysteries before. He has high standards, and I don't want him to think I don't measure up. This past weekend, though, I was part of the faculty at the same conference, and I threw caution to the wind and, enlisting the help of Book Passage's book buyer, Louisa Smith, as go-between, asked Otto if he would be interviewed. Naturally, he agreed. Here is Otto Penzler. Hi, this is Nancy Clare, and we're up in Corte Madera, California, and my guest today is Otto Penzler, who has many attributes that go along with his name. He's the proprietor of arguably the country's best mystery bookstore. He helms and is editor-in-chief of the publishing imprint Mysterious Press, and the editor of more than 50 short story anthologies. Welcome, Otto.
Thank you, Nancy.
Was I correct in the description, in your career description?
Largely. I also own a publishing company called themysteriouspress.com, which is devoted entirely to electronic books.
So that's your 21st century.
That's my moving into the 20th century for me, being a technophobe under most circumstances.
You love mystery short stories. In fact, because of you, I've started to read more mystery short stories. But for those who don't yet read them regularly, why are they important to the genre?
There are many ways to answer that, because there are many different kinds of short stories. John Dixon Carr, the great detective fiction writer who specialized in writing impossible crimes and locked room stories, once said that the natural form of the detective story is the short story rather than the novel, because in detective stories, most books hinge on a single episode, a single clue, a single thing that changes the face of the story. And you can tell that in a short story just as well as in a novel. The rest is filler. There are many other kinds of short stories that are not pure detective stories, and there are pluses and minuses in all of them as opposed to a short story as opposed to a novel. Novel gives you greater opportunity, obviously, to develop characters and to flesh out a narrative, whereas a short story is more direct, more quick to the finish line, as it were. Short story anthology has a lot of things to recommend it. It's like opening a box of chocolate, a Whitman sampler, where you get, or going to a party. It's more like going to a party where you recognize some people, some writers are in that book that you know, that you've liked before, probably one of the reasons that you bought the book. And then you're going to discover new writers. Inevitably, there are writers there that you've never seen before. It's like meeting new people at a party. It's one of the great attractions that I've always had for the anthology form.
What are some of your favorite stories, and if someone is new to the mystery short story, what are some of the must-reads? And I guess I would add that Sherlock Holmes is definitely Arthur Conan Doyle's stories should be in there.
Absolutely. Certainly Edgar Allan Poe, who invented the mystery short story, the detective short story, in 1841 with a story called Murders in the Rue Morgue. And then the next important milestone in the history of the detective short story is Arthur Conan Doyle and the Sherlock Holmes stories, because even though Poe invented the form, he did not popularize it. It did not become a new phenomenon where everybody was racing to write short stories. It's only when Conan Doyle created Sherlock Holmes and the short stories, not even the first two novels, but the short stories, where the short detective story began its boom, and everyone followed. Every publisher wanted the new Sherlock Holmes. Every writer wanted the success that Conan Doyle had. There are many other great writers in that form. Almost everyone that we know in the history of mystery fiction has written some good short stories. Agatha Christie, Dorothy Sayers, Ellery Queen, Dashiell Hammett, Raymond Chandler have all written short mystery short stories and did it very well.
I think Ross MacDonald and his wife, whose name I'm blanking on.
Margaret Miller
wrote amazing short stories. She wrote amazing short stories.
They were both very adept at short story writing as well as writing novels.
So the subject of short stories brings me to Robert Olin Butler, who's one of your writers, and you are his editor.
I edit his books and I publish them, yes.
And his series about, he told me the story, his series about Christopher Marlowe Cobb, Kit Cobb, grew from a short story called The One in White that you encouraged him to transform into a mystery. And that story and that idea evolved into The Hot Country, which is the first of the three books that he's written.
Correct.
Why? What was it about that story that triggered an instinct in you that it would make a great series, that could evolve into this amazing character?
What was remarkable about that story, I don't know if you know, but he collected postcards.
And I have a picture of the postcard, yeah.
Right, and we used it on the end paper.
And it's on the website, for those of you listening.
And it's on the website. But it was a picture of this this young woman in a white dress walking down the street, and on the street is a dead body, a corpse. And the note on the postcard, on the back of the postcard, that the person who bought the postcard sent to someone was, "The woman in white does my laundry." And he wrote a short story around it. And it was just a brilliant short story, showing that this woman was more than a laundress. There were depths to her. And I just thought the setting, the idea of this character, this simple, apparently simple woman who just did laundry, had so much more going on. I thought that could be developed into something bigger. And I was really looking for him to really develop that into a short story that was a crime story. And as we talked more and more about it, the idea of developing it into a novel became more and more attractive. And then the idea of making it a series character with wonderful opportunities. This is before World War I, where this journalist becomes a spy for the United States.
In Veracruz,
and then later in Paris and in Berlin and in other parts of the world.
South of England. I mean, he really, when I talked to Mr. Butler about it, he said it was such a fascinating time in the history of the world because, like now, it was a time of great change. And I thought the three books, and I thought even The One in White begins to capture that. It's changing. This character who becomes a spy has technology at his fingertips, literally with a portable typewriter, that even 15 years before was not available. So there was lots of, you know, how technology is going to change the war, and I think it's a brilliant series, and just that it came from this short story was sort of this amazing leap, and that's what I wanted to get to the core of.
Robert Olin Butler is such a wonderful writer, and he won a Pulitzer Prize for a short story collection, so he knows the short form. But he also knows his history. He did his research on this, and all of the books in that series are based on true events.
You got the sinking of the Lusitania, and
the Zimmerman letter.
The Zimmerman letter and the early blitzkrieg of World War I, mm-hmm. via Zeppelin.
The Zeppelins, yeah.
And the beginning of radio transmissions, and it was a revelation to me. I mean, I'm now his biggest fangirl. But you've had a long career in the genre, in spite of your youth. What are the most significant changes you've seen in the mystery thriller genre during your career?
That's a question. I've been interviewed many, many times because I've been so deeply involved in the mystery for now more than 40 years. Different answers as time has gone by. In the 80s, when I was asked that question, I would say the major difference is that women writers are now writing tougher books, hard-boiled books. It was a time where Marcia Muller had really become the first modern writer to write hard-boiled female private eyes. And then she was joined by Sarah Paretsky and Sue Grafton, both in 1982. And then The Deluge, everybody was writing that. And that had really rarely been done before. There were a couple of relatively hard-boiled writers or noir writers who were female. Obviously, Patricia Highsmith being the pinnacle, but also Dorothy B. Hughes and Lee Brackett. But it really wasn't until the late 70s, early 80s, where women started to write tougher books. And that was a major change. Soon after, and what I think is the most significant change in the history of mystery fiction since I've been involved in the genre, was the fact that it's become far more literary. Literary writers who made their reputations, became successful writing so-called literary fiction, have moved into the detective story or the crime story, the murder story, the noir story, Robert Olin Butler being one of them, Joyce Carol Oates.
John Banville. As Benjamin Black.
And many others, Mario Vargas Llosa, even Thomas Pynchon is writing about an L.A. private eye. They're not very good, but he's trying. So to see literary writers moving into the crime fiction area is one element of that. The other element is that a lot of mystery writers, crime writers, have become far more literary. You could read somebody like Dennis Lehane or Michael Connelly and George Pelicanos, Thomas H. Cook, wonderful, wonderful mystery writers who write novels in which crime happens to occur. They are every bit as good at writing prose as any non-mystery writer, literary writer.
So do you think it's time that this ghettoization, this genreization needs to be moved away from the idea that, oh, it's just a mystery, that this, and I think it still exists. I think there still is a divide among so-called literary writers and the idea of a mystery writer in the perception of the reading public.
Well, to some degree, that's true, and to some degree, it's fair, because a very large number of mystery writers write pure mystery stories without any pretension about writing literary fiction. A lot of paperback originals, a lot of, I know I'm going to get hell for this, but the equivalent of chick lit in the mystery world. You know,
Cozies,
hairdresser mystery, hairdressers,
cat mysteries. 15s,
cat mysteries, fashion mysteries, culinary mysteries. They're designed to be light entertainment, and they don't want to be any more than that, and they're good at what they are. It's like watching television sitcoms. Mm-hmm. It's not like watching a great movie.
It's a snack.
Exactly. It's not a meal.
It's an amuse-bouche,
yeah.
Or an amuse-eye. Because a lot of, I was in Scotland. I attended the first ever Bloody Scotland Crime Writing Festival. And they had a panel, and Ian Rankin was on it, and they talking about the man Booker, and is it time for, a crime fiction writer. And some of, there's amazing writers on both sides of the pond. Ian Rankin is one of them. Mm-hmm. His Standing in Another Man's Grave is it's a literary work.
Right.
Why is someone like him or Val McDermott, why are they excluded? And I think that those that work in the genre and in publishing itself are beginning to think about that. It's beginning to be a question. That's my editorialization of it.
But listen, I've had this position for many, many years. When I was an English major at University of Michigan, and when I came out, I had all the arrogance that every other 20-year-old has, and I started to read. I was tired. My head hurt from reading too much contemporary poetry, too much James Joyce, too much Melville. You know, my head hurt.
Melville, Dickens, Upton Sinclair that we talked about last night. Because I did a lot of American literature, too, and are you going to say that all you wanted to read after that was mysteries?
All I wanted to do was read something, because I couldn't stop reading. I loved reading more than anything. And I thought, well, let me read something that's nice and easy on the brain, nothing I have to think about. And so I started reading mysteries for the first time. I didn't read mysteries when I was young. And suddenly learned when I read Raymond Chandler, and when I read James M. Cain, and when I read Dorothy Sayers and Dashiell Hammett, this is serious literature. It happens to involve a crime. It happens to involve tough guys in many cases. But there's nothing less about it than Hemingway or Fitzgerald or, God knows, Theodore Dreiser and Sinclair Lewis.
When I was in high school, I read. I like to say that I got into Ross MacDonald's Zebra-Striped Hearse and never got out. Do you think the increasing demand for mystery thriller content for live-action series on broadcast cable and streaming helps or hurts the genre? You know, it's uneven at best, but I'm wondering, does it help or does it hurt the writing of the genre?
I don't think it really has an effect one way or the other. You know, television and what television telecasts is cyclical. It's not that long ago where there were very few crime shows on TV. There's always some, because it's an endlessly interesting form. It engages people in the way that a lot of other things don't. But then the cycle goes, or the pendulum swings the other way, and everybody wants more and more and more of that. Whether it has an effect on writing, I don't think it does. I'm not sure that people who read a great deal also watch television a great deal. I think they're kind of separate audiences to some degree. Sure, people who watch TV also read. Readers also watch TV. But the ones with a huge appetite for television probably aren't reading all that much. I think the mystery fiction as a literary form is successful now. It was successful 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, etc., and will be in the future. Whether there are more FX broadcasts of thrillers or something, I don't think it's going to affect the number of books or the quality.
One writer I interviewed did say, though, she had sold the rights to her character. I can't remember. I think it was USA. And I asked if she was going to be involved, and she said, well, you know, it was funny. She says, I don't think they want to make me unhappy, but no, I'm not contractually involved. So I said, you know, well, what, you know, why did you do it? And she goes, well, part of it is economic. You know, a writer's life is very difficult economically. And the other was, it might entice readers. So that's one of the reasons I asked that question was, you know, but you don't necessarily think that that would happen. You don't necessarily think that...
No, I think when somebody's book is made into a movie, three things can happen. One is nothing. That it's a decent movie, people go, they like it, and they have no idea who wrote the book on which it was based. The other is so bad that people do know who wrote the book, and they never want to read that author again because they blame the author. And the third and the most unlikely of the scenarios is that it's a fantastic movie and everybody wants to rush out and read that book and every other book by that writer.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
It's like Woody Hayes, the famous coach at Ohio State, who his reaction to the forward pass said three things can happen, two of which are bad, an incompletion or an interception.
It didn't stop the forward pass
from being used
throughout history, both in college ball and then in professional.
Let me give an example of this. Sarah Paretsky Her V.I. Warshawski series had made the New York Times bestseller list 4 books in a row, 5 books in a row, and then Kathleen Turner made a movie called V.I. Warshawski, or whatever it was called, V.I. or
V.I., I think.
Yeah. Which was a dreadful, dreadful movie.
It was insulting and painful and
awful. Sarah did not make the bestseller list again for the next 3 or 4 books.
Yeah, it was so bad it hurt everyone's feelings.
She's back on, yeah. You know, but I think she got blamed for that horrific movie.
Well, but then there's, in the defense of this, there are series like Bosch, which I think they did a very, very good job with. I think they picked a good person to play Harry.
I'm told.
And I have to think that, especially Michael Connelly's torturous journey to regaining the rights to his character, the broadcast rights to Harry Bosch again, I think the game has changed with the idea of the serialization of a story like The Wire, which George Pelicanos was involved in, has changed it. It's not, they're not episodic. They don't have to have the entire story arc in each episode.
Well, that's true for a few series, but not for most series. And The Wire wasn't based on a novel.
No, it was created from whole cloth.
Yeah, and the Bosch series, Michael Connelly was already number one in America. He was already outselling everybody else. So did it help his sales? It may have a few, but I don't think it had a profound influence one way or the other.
So here's my last question. You and I are participating in the Mystery Writers Conference at Book Passage, which is an independent bookstore in Corte Madera, California, and which it's a conference for aspiring writers. And what would your advice be to them? You know, what directions do you see the mystery genre going? What would you say to these writers who would either want to approach you as a bookseller or as a editor-in-chief and publisher? Both for MysteriousPress.com and for Mysterious Press in hard copy?
Well, what I would say is write the best book you can. And look, I have several consultations this weekend. I have one this afternoon where I've read sample pages of books that aspiring writers or writers, but pre-published writers, we like to say, have given me. And I would not say, oh, here's a trend in mystery fiction. Try to write for that trend. That's insanity. Write the best book you can. And I've been saying this, I've been talking about this sort of thing and working with young writers or unpublished writers for many, many years, off and on. And I always say the same thing, you know, by the time, if you spot a trend and you decide to write for it, by the time your book is ready and published, that trend will have peaked and be on its way down. You start the trend. You write the best book you know how to write in any of the subgenres. I don't care if it's a thriller or a police procedural or a private eye or a cop novel or a noir novel, suspense. Just write the best book you can. That's the only advice that anybody
can give. Don't be a dedicated follower of writing fashion.
Definitely. In fact, try to avoid that.
So different drummer. Different drummer is good.
Absolutely.
Thanks again, Otto. It's been really great.
Sure.
Next week, Speaking of Mysteries, we'll have 2 episodes. We'll be talking to Vu Tran about his debut noir novel, Dragonfish, about the Vietnamese underground in Las Vegas, and Tom Bowman about his Edgar Award winner, Dry Bones in the Valley, about a rural policeman with 2 murder investigations that reignite old feuds and threaten to start new ones. This is Nancy Clare. Thank you again for listening to Speaking of Mysteries.